Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for March 6, 2003. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And it's been a few weeks since I've been here, so if I remember how to do this. I've got two guests scheduled for tonight. First, we'll speak with Amit Tonak, who is a professor at Simon's Rock campus of Bard College in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, about Turkey, and Turkey and the coming war with Iraq. Maybe I shouldn't keep saying that, because the White House's plan is to make the war seem inevitable, and we all play along. But when we say the coming war with Iraq, the war with Iraq that we hope we can stop, let's put it that way. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with Ed Vogliani, who is a correspondent for the Observer newspaper based in London, who, among many other things, participated in breaking a story that the Observer published last Sunday on how the United States was spying on the representatives to the UN Security Council. And we'll speak with Ed Vogliani about that story, repercussions around the UN, and also just what it's like to cover this strange country for a foreign audience, and to read our media, which often don't cover it as well as foreign newspapers do. And before we get to Amit Tonak, just a couple of announcements. Tatu, the Russian lesbian pop duo, who have played several times on this show, was on The Tonight Show last week with Jay Leno, and they wore some T-shirts that said in Russian, a rather obscene expression, F, you know, I can't say that word, because Michael Powell will be at my door if I do, but F the war. They said it in Russian, nobody understood that, but it was on their T-shirts, and all the Russian-reading viewers of The Tonight Show saw it, but no one in the staff understood it. They did get in a lot of trouble afterwards, and their next TV show that they were scheduled to be on in their U.S. tour, they were told they weren't allowed to wear their shirts, so instead, they took off their shirts and said, we'll perform topless, and the staff at the next network didn't like that idea, so instead they wrote censored on their T-shirts. But anyway, not only do they make some fine music, they have good politics and are willing to do nervy things to protest the war, even if it's over the heads of most Americans. And this coming up this Sunday, March 9, 2003, the Foundry Roundtable series, sponsored by the Foundry Theater, discussing the U.S. national economy, the state of it. And on that panel will be me and Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, moderated by Seth Ackerman, who is formerly of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting and now is just a wise young man about town. Again, that's this coming Sunday at 2 p.m., 2 to 4:30 p.m., at St. Mark's Church in the Bowery, 2nd Avenue and 10th Street in Manhattan. That's Sunday, 2 p.m., St. Mark's in the Bowery, 2nd Avenue and 10th Street in Manhattan. Me and Dean Baker talking about the U.S. economy. And now we're joined by, speaking of the U.S. economy, it's not doing too well. It really hasn't changed since the last time I was here. It's sort of flat in its back. It can't get up. It's not collapsing, but it's not recovering either. And the war certainly isn't helping, but anxiety about the war certainly isn't helping. But it's got a lot of its own problems, and we'll get to that in the coming weeks. But now, I'm joined by Amit Tonak, who is a professor of economics at Simon's Rock College, which is a campus of Bard in Western Massachusetts. Welcome to WBAI, Amit Tonak.
Hi, how are you?
So thank you for joining us. So let's start with the Turkish parliament vote the other day. Were you surprised by the rejection of the U.S. deployment?
Somewhat, although I was attaching a slim possibility of this kind of rejection by the parliament.
And now we're hearing a lot of talk about a second vote. Do you think that's going to happen, and will the decision be reversed?
It seems quite likely, especially after the announcement of Chief of Staff of Turkish military yesterday, it seems to me many people started to justify for the second motion, and especially within the governing party, Justice and Development Party, seemingly some of the members of that party started to change their opinion.
Tell us a bit about that party. I mean, they're cast as kind of an Islamic party, but Turkey has been historically a secular state. How do they fit in? What's the party all about?
It is an Islamic party in the sense that the origin of many politicians within the party, and including actually the leader of the party, Tayyip Erdogan, came from the previously existing religious parties in Turkey, and many of them were banned by the constitutional court in Turkey. And actually, Tayyip Erdogan himself was the mayor of Istanbul. And as the other Islamic parties were banned, and this group of people under the leadership of Tayyip Erdogan and used the vacuum, and a political vacuum, and established this party roughly a year and a half ago. And although they distinguished themselves in terms of making explicit statements regarding, you know, secular nature of Turkish, you know, state, and because of the popularity, especially of Tayyip Erdogan and in Istanbul and other, you know, metropolitan areas throughout, you know, Turkey, and also having some sort of popular discourse. And I think some people thought that this is an alternative to depreciated, you know, political parties of Turkey. And because of that, I think they received rather substantial support in this last November election.
Now, does that mean that a lot of the Turkish population is religious or upholds an Islamist agenda, or is it just because there's not much in the way of dissent and that's just an outlet?
Actually, there are two elements to explain this party's, you know, popularity. One is rather historical, in the sense that as new Turkish Republic established in 1923 after the disintegration of Ottoman Empire, and the leadership of Republican People's Party, which was the single party at the time, the Atatürk's party, was explicitly a modernizer, and, you know, and attempted to institute and bring many of, you know, Western institutions, you know, to Turkey, and establishing, you know, secular, you know, regime in Turkey again, you know, very openly, and without taking into consideration, you know, very much, you know, cultural and religious traditions of the population. And after a while, and especially last 20 years or so, I think, you know, we've been observing in Turkey that, you know, there was some sort of reaction to this, one might even say, you know, imposition of, you know, certain institutions on the Turkish, you know, population 1920 on. So that is, you know, one element. The other element is obviously the Cold War, and especially 1971 and 1980, when Turkey experienced two military coups, and then at the end of the Cold War, and the left, you know, generally, and also in Turkey specifically, lost, you know, its, you know, credibility and prestige. So in that sense, obviously, politicized Islam again, you know, filled the vacuum and somehow, you know, presented itself as an alternative to mainstream politics.
Historically, the U.S. has sort of either tacitly or not so tacitly encouraged religious alternatives rather than some sort of secular leftist traditions. And we saw that across a bit of the Middle East, and now, of course, we're reaping some of the harvest of that. Did anything like that obtain in Turkey? Was there a U.S. Preference for religious parties over secular leftists or not?
That was not as explicit in some other countries, you know, throughout the Middle East. In the case of, you know, Turkey, I might say, because I think Turkey had always alternatives to religious, you know, parties, and, you know, centrist parties, and even the left of, you know, center parties, social democratic parties, and have been traditionally quite friendly with United States administration. So in that context, I don't think that United States, you know, explicitly register, you know, its preference, you know, toward, you know, Islamic parties in the case of Turkey.
I'm speaking with Ahmet Tonak, professor of economics at Simon's Rock College of Bard in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. And Turkey, the Turkish economy has been in fairly dismal shape, and it looked like the United States was in large part trying to buy the vote through promises of aid and help from the IMF. Could you lay the background out of just how badly has Turkey's economy been doing in recent years, and what was the United States trying to offer as its lure to the Turkish parliament to vote the troops in?
Specifically, especially in the context of, you know, recent negotiations, you know, which were covered extensively in American media, in terms of this, you know, package, you know, $20 billion, $28 billion, different numbers, and, you know, ability of Turkish government and bargain. And in that context, I would suggest that I think, you know, one of the determining, you know, element from the Turkish point of view was obviously the first Gulf War, because that was, you know, devastating on Turkish economy. And given the fact that Iraq was Turkey's, you know, second largest trade partner after Germany, and the trade volume, for example, just before the Gulf War was around, you know, $2.5 billion a year with Iraq, and then immediately after the war declined to $122 million. And then the following years, you know, 10 and 11 years, and there are estimates around in terms of effect, negative effect of Gulf War on Turkish economy. I've seen some numbers as high as, you know, $100 billion, although there are other numbers around, you know, $40-50 billion, and out of which, if we assume that, for example, Turkey lost roughly $2.5 billion trade earning from Iraq, and at least, you know, $25-30 billion come from that, you know, trade opportunity Turkey had, and in the meantime, the United States administration promised to Turkey, because of its participation to Gulf War, roughly $1 billion. Aid, and which didn't materialize. So because of that, I think, you know, these negotiations, you know, partially took a bit time, and then finally there was no agreement. And the current estimates, for example, this, you know, forthcoming war changes, you know, from $15 billion, which is a conservative estimate in my view by Morgan Trust, to all the way to $150 billion. There are obviously, you know, several reasons, you know, for these varied numbers, because of the assumptions, you know, people make either in relation to export, you know, earnings of Turkey, or lost tourism revenues, or duration of the war, and this and that. And the other aspect of these negotiations, and which is much more directed to your question, has to do with, you know, IMF stabilization policies, you know, in Turkey. I think U.S. administration currently, in its negotiations, you know, with Turkish government, specifically ask from Turkish government that the stabilization policies, you know, should be followed, you know, very strictly. And that was kind of, you know, consistent with this Justice and Democratic Development Party, I should say, economic policies. But at the same time, it gives almost, you know, no room whatsoever to maneuver around and to satisfy some of the, you know, popular, you know, support of the party. And because of that, for example, as soon as this vote takes place in the parliament, a new budget proposed by the governing party, which is extremely conservative and extremely restrictive. So in that sense, and I think the economic program of this, you know, current party is many ways similar to the previous parties, and then this rather so-called, you know, stabilization, you know, program will continue with full force.
Well, that stabilization program hasn't brought much stability, has it? It's brought crisis and depression.
Exactly, and especially year 2000 and 2001, you know, Turkey experienced, you know, in real terms, you know, GDP growth rate decline, and income distribution obviously was worsened because of these, you know, policies. And I mean, I could cite, you know, some numbers, you know, which are rather obscene. For example, when you look at the income distribution in Turkey, and let's look at, for example, 1980, there was essentially no interest income as such, but because of the systematic, you know, policies of governments, you know, since 1980, due to this financial, you know, liberalization and, you know, opening economy completely to external, you know, foreign capital inflows. And what we have now, roughly, I think, 17-18% of total income is essentially interest income. And that is more or less equal to agricultural sectors, you know, value added, where roughly 40% of, you know, civilian labor force located. I mean, it is in that sense, and I think comparing, you know, financial capital's, you know, earnings relative to agricultural, you know, sectors' contribution to economy, and proportions obviously are highly unacceptable. And similar things happening in the manufacturing sector as well. When you look at, for example, productivity gains in manufacturing sector since 1980, and I think it almost, you know, tripled. On the other hand, you know, wage increases stagnant, and still, for example, in terms of, you know, large companies in manufacturing sector, for example, we have data for these specific enterprises, and wages are at the same level where they were in 1980, and whereas, you know, these huge productivity gains materialized. In that regard, I
So if wages are flat and productivity tripled, that means that somebody made a lot of money off someone else's labor. Who made all that money?
I think, you know, finance capital. When I say finance capital, it doesn't mean exclusively, you know, foreign capital, although there is a lot of hot money and coming in and, you know, leaving and the country as soon as, you know, basically situations are not conducive of staying in, you know, Turkish markets. But at the same time, the super rich, and especially those group of people and institutions that control, you know, large funds and steadily lending money in order to close this, you know, budget deficit, Turkish government, and the interest payments on domestic debt is again, you know, rather obscene levels. It is, you know, for example, 55% of, for example, this year's, you know, budget goes to directly domestic debt interest payments.
The government is spending more than half its budget on interest payments.
Yes.
That's a very large amount. There's not much left to do much of anything else, is
exactly
there?
And especially, and when you say, you know, budget, you know, 55%, this includes also a lot of revenues generated lately from privatization of state economic enterprises. And you look at, you know, specifically, for example, government tax revenues, and this year's domestic debt interest payments is more than actually what tax revenues are, more than 100%. So this situation obviously is not sustainable, and there should be addressed, you know, one way or another.
So with all this in mind, with the economy in dire shape, and the United States at least promising some kind of aid package, still over 90% of the Turkish population oppose the acceptance of U.S. troops. Is that, that's correct, right?
Yes.
And the vote in Parliament, though, was very close. I mean, it was just a plurality but not a majority, so the motion failed. How do these legislators justify voting against the interests of 90 or 95% of the population?
This is related to whether I think Turkey should be considered as an ideal democracy, as, again, American media and United States administration constantly presenting, you know, Turkey as a model democracy.
Yeah, it's supposed to be the model for Iraq to start with, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think if one's criteria for democracy are regionally based, and this description of Turkey as a model country might be acceptable in the context of the Middle East, because as we all know, most of the countries are under either family rule or individual or single party totalitarian regimes. So in that context, you know, it may make sense. However, when you look at, you know, Turkish practices of, you know, democracy, and when we objectively judge the political situation in Turkey, I think we should point out that the democracy in Turkey has been developing with its own ups and downs. And I would add to that, to support, you know, my, you know, critical judgment about a Turkish democratic experiment, I would refer to, for example, three military interventions, in Turkey, one in 1960 and 1971 and 1980 in my own lifetime. And in all of those, cases, the parliamentary democratic regime was interrupted with all kinds of human rights violations, and including, by the way, and in the first one, 1960, the prime minister, foreign affairs minister, and treasury minister were hanged. And so, and as we all know, also Turkey is interested to become part of European Union. And every time it applies to be considered, and many European countries, constantly exploit these human rights violations and then military intervention, and by referring to Turkish, recent, history. And just to add, more, whether it is an ideal democracy or not, and many religious parties recently, banned because of their affiliation with, Islamic tradition. And I would also add that, leftist parties, were crashed and, constantly challenged by constitutional courts. One of the most recent cases, for example, has to do with Turkish Communist Party that is, supposedly legal party, but somehow, its name and the fact that they use, communists, irritated, many people, and they are challenged by the constitutional court. And they're saying that they're not going to change their name. And so and these things are obvious to observe, and these things are happening, in Turkey, and which very much, obviously damaging, the image of, full democracy in Turkey.
Now, the army plays a very large role in Turkish government, right? Even leaving aside the coups in the recent past, I mean, still, it's a very influential force, right?
Very much so. I think that is partially historical, and I think we should also say that Turkey, especially after disintegration of Ottoman Empire, when completely occupied by Western powers, had, first very successful national liberation war and an anti-imperialist war. So, and because of the prestige of the Turkish army, since then, gained, because of, successful national liberation war and establishing a new Turkish Republic as an independent, state. And obviously has a very important, place and image, within, Turkish politics. And having said this, and somehow, also Turkish military attribute, some, special function in political, setup in Turkey. As soon as, they realize that, something is happening contrary to their image of, Turkey, what it's supposed to be, so to speak, they feel that they should make statement, and as it happened, by the way, just yesterday in the case of this, parliamentary vote, or sometimes actually they intervene and abolish a parliamentary regime. However, I'm not anticipating, anything drastic like, military coup is likely anymore in Turkey because of, I guess, establishment of democratic institutions, and they are a bit more solid nowadays, compared to 30 years ago, 40 years ago. And secondly, I think the possibility of becoming a member of European Union in a way prevents, military engaging in that kind of adventure anymore.
Now, does the army want to get a piece of northern Iraq? Do they have an interest in intervening in the war?
I don't think there is explicit, agenda occupying, northern Iraq and incorporating into Turkey. But I think, and especially the army in Turkey is extremely nervous relative to Kurdish presence in northern Iraq, especially if these, Kurdish groups join together their forces and declare their, independence and establish some sort of autonomous state, even within the context of federated Iraq. And that seems quite unacceptable to Turkish military. So in order to prevent that, they would like to be present in northern Iraq. And actually currently, according to recent news coverage from Turkey, roughly 10,000 Turkish military personnel already in northern Iraq, and then close to 60,000 situated in the southeastern part of Turkey and ready to intervene if anything happens there.
And they're also trying to prevent a flood of refugees into Turkey?
There is that. And as you know, last time during the Gulf War, almost close to a million Kurds and left and where they were, and then hundreds of thousands of them basically moved to Turkey.
Finally, what do you think the reaction of the Turkish people would be if the parliament is obviously forced under intense pressure from the U.S. to hold another vote? I've heard some people say it's like the Turks will rise up and reject this. So what do you see?
It is difficult to anticipate the level of opposition if that kind of decision takes place in the parliament itself. But my reading the situation from distance is that I think this time progressives, anti-war activists are organized quite effectively, and the support is extremely widespread, and it is not only just the small group of leftists, and I think many segments of society join their forces. Otherwise, we cannot explain 95% in opposition to this idea anyway. But also, I don't think they're staying calm, and many people, for example, participating demonstrations first time in their life, and it's somewhat similar in that regard, actually, what we are observing in the United States. So it is hard to anticipate fully what the reaction would be, but I think it will be rather dramatic.
Yeah, it's amazing. It seems like George W. Bush is contributing more to building a global anti-imperialist movement than any of us ever could.
Exactly.
Thank you for joining us, Amit Tonak.
It's my pleasure.
Amit Tonak is a professor of economics at the Simon's Rock campus of Bard College in the Berkshires in Massachusetts. And let's take a little listen to Billy Bragg's International, and we'll be back to speak with Ed Vulliamy.
Victims of oppression, for the tyrants fear your might. Don't cling so hard to your possessions, for you have nothing, you have no rights. Let racist ignorance be ended, for respect makes the empire's fall. Freedom is merely privilege extended.
Before their eyes.
That was Billy Bragg's version of the Internationale, which is appropriate at this moment. And I thought I was going to be able to get Ed Wilyami. It was a last-minute plan this afternoon, and it looked good, but we can't raise him, so we have to go with Plan B, which is an interviewer required quite a radical change of pace here, but, you know, consistency. Foolish. A foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds. An interview recorded last week with Susie Bright, who is a writer on sex and erotica, and also the editor of the Best Erotica of 2003, just published by Simon & Schuster and their Torch Book imprint. And there's actually a lot of social political content to it, so it's not all about sex for you Puritans out there. So let's go with Plan B and listen to this interview recorded last week with Susie Bright.
Welcome to WBAI, Susie Bright, the 10th anniversary edition of the Best American Erotica. What's happened in the field over the last 10 years? Has it changed?
Well, in 1993, when I got the call, you know, from a major New York publisher asking me to put together a best of erotic anthology, I could tell that they considered it a rather risky novelty. At the time, we were just coming into a period where mainstream bookstores who had been either shaky about selling erotic fiction, or they didn't know where to shelve it, you know, or they were like, maybe we should hide it behind the table, and then if someone asks, and I was like, oh my God, you know, the death blow, someone has to ask for it. You know, only the bravest, only the most subversive will come up and ask. So it was quite a change to see what would happen in the next few years. I remember coming here to New York City. This was when Borders had a bookstore at the bottom of the World Trade Center. And the manager ushered me in. She said, thank God for you. If it wasn't for business and sex books, we'd be out of business. And I know that we created a boom, so to speak, some of which was very good, some of which was awful. There's a tendency for people to take advantage of the erotic literature popularity and say, hey, those slobs, you know, all you have to do is put a couple of dirty words on a page, take a rubber stamp, call it erotica, and it sells, you know. Oh God, that just kills me, because I know some people are still buying their first erotic book, and if they pick something up that is cheesy, stupid, not arousing, not original, they'll just think it's all a big con. And there's too much of that in popular culture, you know, so I keep trying to stress some kind of authentic, this is the real thing quality. Also, you know, we just have such a different look at American lives in the erotica that I see now. It used to be that erotica seemed almost quaint, the very word. It was British Victorian spanking fantasies, or it was Anais Nin writing in her garret for her daily bread, you know, trying to think of a new erotic vignette. Or maybe it was Henry Miller, you know, swaggering and swearing and his stream of consciousness craziness, which is beautiful, but at this point, dated. And so nowadays, when you think of modern erotica, you're like, it's like, I hear America singing. You really hear the lives that are being lived. You hear from every corner. I mean, one of the things that intrigues me about a story is when I see characters who I can tell, yes, they're so believable. I know these people are out there, but I had no idea this is what their life was like. You know, they're a truck driver in North Carolina. They're a transsexual in a Los Angeles barrio. You know, who are they? What are they all about? Well, I find out in these stories. An elderly couple on the Canadian border in the snow. I mean, who are these people? Well, they have lives, which means they have erotic lives, and I'm hearing about them from authors today. People are not interested in formula. It's the exact opposite of what you might call a penthouse letter, where you know, okay, here comes the pizza delivery boy, there will be a housewife in a negligee, and then when people do bring up those kind of tropes, it's to make fun of them or to subvert them, like, but the lady in the negligee really turns out to be her husband, you know, everything's a big mix-up, you know, the pizza delivery boy turns out to be a professor, you know, whatever, it's got to be real, it's got to be as crazy as real life is.
People who live in major metropolitan areas sometimes think that folks in the heartland are repressed and very conventional.
Oh, boy, are they wrong.
I was going to say, obviously you found out different. You get a lot of stuff from places outside the coast.
Yeah, I mean, I think I get more people from the big cities simply because there's more people there. You know, just that kind of statistics, it works out. But I will always get fascinating stories from a little town in Nebraska I had never heard of, and I'll get it from Virginia, and I'll get it from Texas, and it doesn't matter.
I'm speaking with Susie Bright, who is the editor of The Best American Erotica, 2003, the 10th anniversary edition of this series. Let's go back to the political, social environment when you started doing this series. Ten years ago, we'd just come out of the era of Andrea Dworkin and Ed Meese persecuting erotica. Does that period feel like ancient history now, safely behind us, or are there still social forces from all sides trying to constrain free expression?
Well, you know, I almost miss the left-wing reproach to sex, because they've been pretty much snuffed out, and the only ones who are still very public in their condemnation are the right wing. And plus, they co-opted all the feminist rhetoric. So now you have religious people coming up to you and saying, that's degrading to women. And you feel like saying, hey, you got that from Andrea Dworkin. You can't use that. Even she wouldn't like it. It's not fair. You took the rhetoric and left the feminist in the gutter. So, you know, sometimes I'll go places and people try, there's certain euphemistic questions where people try to trick you. They try to, bring up the issue that's supposed to make me freak out. Like, well, Susie, what about children? Okay, that's a good one. That's a really good one. You know, what do they think I'm going to do? Burst into tears? Or do they think the monster's going to come out and say, yes, I'm trying to take every child into my bed that I can get my hands on?
I'll leave that to Michael Jeff.
Oh, God. Yeah, one is enough. So, he's kind of, they're supposed to be trick questions to get me to expose that I'm really, immoral? That I don't have any boundaries, that, you know, what I'm suggesting is dangerous and destructive. And of course, the things they're asking, I do have some thoughtful and sincere reactions to. I think the whole question of when does one become aware of your sexuality and sexual self-consciousness and how that changes through childhood and adolescence and what it means to start sharing your sexual thoughts and then sharing your body with another person, those are really good questions. But the kind of people who jab at you about age of consent, children, pornography, they are not interested in this. In fact, if I could strip away their titillating trash talk, because really they just have potty mouths, they're like right-wing potty mouths, if you could take that away, they really don't want anyone to see pornography. They don't want grown men and grown women to either. And you used to be able to, this is an interesting change, you used to be able to say that grown women should be protected from this. When I started publishing erotica, you could still say, women need not see this. Women will be hurt. Now, no one will buy that. It's like grown women, that's a jaded group.
Well, the cliche was that women didn't enjoy it either.
They didn't enjoy it. They were offended. They were so delicate.
And you were one of the leading edges of proving that not to be the case.
Yes, and of course some women still don't like it, but I don't think even the offended women want to be described as delicate. So that's out the window. The only people left to talk about are children, because of course they can't stand up for themselves, say their point of view. So, but the people who are putting this forward, their idea of a perfect world is in which they perhaps sit on a very clandestine elite review board, and they get to look at everything, like the Vatican, and they keep it in their secret library. No one else is allowed to look at it except them, because they are educated enough, and they have, you know, the wisdom, the moral superiority that they can handle it. Ha, ha, ha. Right? And the rest of us should be left in the dark, and should be frightened, and should be superstitious about sex, and should be ignorant and fearful and all the rest. So there's still plenty of that. And sometimes it pops out in, you know, I'll be in certain academic environments, I would say. That's where it still happens, sometimes on campus. And someone will, you
among
know,
students or faculty people?
I would say students who are having an infatuation with one of their professors who sort of is like the prime of Miss Jean Brody and has got them all whipped up about the dangers of pornography and men being evil and so on, and they want to, their little students then go out into the field and try to get, you know, take Susie right on, and you're going to burst her bubble. And I try to, instead of like having some sort of Camille Paglia-esque reaction to them, because I'm really not, even though I'm being sarcastic with you, I'm actually much more compassionate when it happens one-on-one. I try to answer them by saying, look, let's put aside the jargon for a moment, and why don't you tell me what you think is appropriate sexuality? Like, what do you think is a wonderful, beautiful, aesthetic, healthy sexual response? Let's talk about that. Like, what are your fantasies? What kind of sex do you look for? What role does desire play in your life? Who do you think you are sexually? Let's just start right there. Forget everybody else. And let's begin with you and something you feel good about. That often will make such a person angry because they want to fight, but some of them are surprised that I give a damn or that I'm not just interested in having a competitive debate. I'm not. I mean, I really have tried a lot to give people the notion that what I'm interested in isn't how many chandeliers you can swing from or how many kinks are in your corner. I'm interested in people expressing and understanding their own sexual philosophy. But, yeah, I've been really looking forward to telling you a more recent development politically with the erotica that I've been seeing, is that so every year I always notice what the zeitgeist is. There's always like a few trends in erotic themes that I get more manuscripts about than usual. And I try to think about, what does that say about the times we live in? And this year, I noticed there were a number of stories that had to do with men who didn't want to be your typical man. They wanted to give all that up. Maybe they wanted to cross-dress. Maybe they wanted to be completely seduced. Maybe they wanted to be roughed up. Maybe they wanted to be very small or soft. Whatever it was, it had some orgasmic ending in it for them. But they did not want to be Uberman. They wanted to be the opposite. They wanted to be Omega Boy. And I thought, you know, I'm having deja vu. I've noticed this before. When did I notice this before? And it just hit me like a hammer. This happened during the first Gulf War. And at the time, I just thought it was another closet door opening. I thought, oh, all those men, that good vibrations, who bought vibrators and ended up using them, you know, they're just coming out of their closet. But now that I realize that I haven't seen that little spike in manuscripts since then, and now it's just suddenly happening right now, makes me realize it's a reaction to a war climate where we're called upon to be, you know, to be as masculine as you can be all that you can be. None of these men are self-conscious of this. None of them said, Susie, I'm a pacifist and I decided to write this submissive male story to show my views. No. They were all just, you know, writing something that turned them on. But there's more of it right now. Why is that? And it just goes to show when people think erotica is just, innocent fluff, there's part of it that isn't innocent fluff from a sociological point of view, from a psychoanalytic point of view. You look at how sexual taboos and reactions change over the years, and it's like a time capsule of what was going on in the world. And
it's not all just personal.
It's not personal anymore.
I'm speaking with Susie Bright, the editor of The Best American Erotica 2003, which is published by Simon & Schuster, the Touchstone imprint. We've got, you know, a fundamentalist in the White House and an administration full of fundamentalists, you know, fighting another brand of fundamentalists on the other side of the world. It's Tariq Ali's book, in his book titled A Clash of Fundamentalisms.
Yes.
And always at the center of these things is anxiety about sex.
Oh, my God, yes.
What is it? Why is this sexual anxiety so central to that kind of politics and that kind of view, the fundamentalist view of the world?
It's interesting, isn't it? Right away, I smelled a rat when the Bush side tried to create a sense of outrage about how the Taliban treated women. Because I thought, look at how you want to treat women. It's disgusting. You know, look at how you want to infantilize American women and children. Look at how you go into the Center for Disease Control and turn it into a complete joke by taking all the condom information down and saying simply, condoms don't work. Abstinence is the only way to prevent STDs. Oh, well, there's a plan. I mean, that is as ridiculous as dressing women from head to toe in black veils. That's how these Muslim fundamentalists think they're going to stop temptation? Well, I guess it hasn't worked. And telling people in America that they should never have sex until they get married and then just with that one person for the rest of their life, guess what? That isn't working either. So why it's so central to both of them, and yet they don't see that about each other. They see it, to me, like a cockfight. You know, like both of them really have nothing but disdain for diplomacy, for negotiation, for compromise, for people who are trying to be reasonable. They don't want to be reasonable, and they are attracted to each other as in that kind of, cockfight kind of way, aren't they? They move a little bit closer to each other all the time. There is something erotic, in a way, in their antagonism towards each other. I mean, I think, okay, here's another idea. You know more about this than I do, but a number of people who have commented on totalitarianism and fascism have commented on certain elements of social control that are always part of the scheme. And certainly controlling women and children and controlling sexuality seems to be almost the cornerstone of, like, how to control your property. It's like, if you can't control them, then you don't get to have a kingdom. Looking back on how sex was our daily media diet when Clinton was in the White House, I mean, it was always such fun. Every day was National Enquirer Day with Monica and Bill. And even at the time, many critics said, this makes me sick to see this getting such play when such serious things are happening in the real world that go unnoticed, don't get the attention they deserve. Now, with Bush in the White House, I think the brinksmanship he's been playing in some way has forced the media to finally respond a little, not only in the area of the war, but, for example, this insane prosecution of the medical marijuana advocate in Northern California. Has that been that much play up here in New York? This man looks like Ralph Nader. You know, the jury wasn't allowed to know what a do-gooder mensch he was. He is just so not a pothead. And when they found out, they, like, all burst into tears and want to apologize to him and held a press conference and said this is absolutely immoral that we were not allowed to know that this man was only following California law to the letter.
Yeah, these states' rights people are fine about overruling local control and when they want to. So Ashcroft is also forcing all the federal prosecutors in New York to go for death penalty, even though it's not popular here.
Exactly. And I think it's like they're just going too far. They can't seem to stop themselves. And the way that we've all thought, well, okay, it's a Republican. Well, we'll just get through this somehow. After all, we survived Nixon. We survived Reagan. There's a sense with Bush that, like, it's crazier than it ever was.
Yeah, these guys seem primitive and more primitive and scarier than Reagan's people did.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm just not remembering things.
Yeah,
something frightening about these guys.
I asked that too. I go, now come on. You were scared about Bush Sr. You were really upset about Reagan. But there, because of this kind of fanaticism, we haven't had, we just haven't had a religious nut in the White House for quite some time, have we?
Well, this country has a long history of, you know, these Puritan religious attitudes and fundamentalism playing a large role in the culture. Do you see that changing in all the years that you've been doing this? Is America growing out of this? And these guys in the White House are really just sort of a residue or a leftover from a different time?
Well, think about the big picture. Remember when we were kids, you and I are about the same age, and when we grew up in the 60s, people still went to church every Sunday. Nearly everybody you knew went to church or went to temple. There was a sense of the church playing a big part in people's lives, and then it all changed. It changed during my childhood. And now you have a great many people in the United States, millions and millions, who either feel like religion is their own little private thing, or they have become extraordinarily attached to New Age philosophies, mixing and matching your Buddhism with your acupuncture, with your whatever, right? And there's, you know, the article of faith that everybody was like, oh yes, you're one of those Protestant denominations. You know, it was kind of bland. It had a lot of room, a lot of flexibility. I think the way a lot of Christian churches reacted to that, well, first of all, the big churches just lost tremendous numbers of supporters and, you know, their Sunday people. Poof, they went away. And the churches that started gaining people were the fringe, because all of a sudden they could kind of be the underdog. They could be the ones saying, we're different, we're hardcore, we have something to offer. You know, this isn't just like put your pennies in the collection plate and sing another hymn. No, we're about revolution. You know, they had something that was going to certainly not appeal to everyone, but was going to appeal to people with an excitement level.
Yeah, well, there is a passion to it, mm-hmm. unlike a lot of more polite forms of religion.
Exactly. So while they're not by any means the mainstream or the majority, they're going to fight back. They're not just going to say, okay, we realize religion just isn't playing the same role it did a century ago. Okay, well, we'll just give up. I have a friend who has one of these really interesting timelines of the world's religions going back to year dot, and it shows how things like dominated for, you know, these centuries and then suddenly got, you know, squeezed real hard, and others that seem to just live for a few moments and poof, disappeared. And it's interesting to see, you know, the kind of ideological hold certain religions have had, and how the ones that are the most ruthless really have stuck around the longest. God, we're up against it, aren't we?
Yeah. They're all over the place. Let's conclude on a happier note by give us a hint of what's in the volume. What kinds of delights might people encounter by picking up a copy of The Best American Erotica 2003?
Well, for one, I decided to celebrate the 10th birthday by asking my readers what their favorite stories were that I've ever published. And I have a list of the top 100 here, and I reprinted the very favorite 5 stories. And then, in the beginning, I interviewed as many of the authors as I could find. It was really funny. I was sort of like calling up people all over. I get people's mothers who would say, I haven't seen him in years. But it was great to talk to them about their writing lives and their sex lives. So I think those are some extra treats in the book. And another thing that people might be interested in who listen to your show is I do a weekly audio program which people can find out about through SusieBright.com. And on my audio show, which is called In Bed with Susie Bright, I've been interviewing a lot of my contributors, and sometimes we read these stories out loud. It's really fun to hear the person who wrote it, you know, what their voice sounds like when they entertain you with their...
And most of the contributors, professional writers or amateurs?
Gosh, you know, I look at that and they're so different. I mean, the famous people in this are Chuck Palahniuk, who did Fight Club, Vaginal Cream Davis, performance artist extraordinaire, William Harrison, screenwriter for Rollerball, Nicholson Baker, Dorothy Allison, Susanna Kazin, who did Girl Interrupted. But then there's people here who have never had a mainstream publishing gig, Greta Christine at Tennessee Jones, Allison L. Smith, Paula Bomer. I mean, well, it's just all over the map. Some of them are genre writers. You'll see people who are famous for their sci-fi or their historical novels and so on. It's an interesting party, I've got to say.
And many different preferences are represented as well. Right?
Absolutely. It's not even fair to say it's gay and straight and bi, because some things you can't even quite put your finger on.
Is something that seems, over the last 10 years or so, that those boundaries have blurred a lot.
Well, that's because writers are great liars and great storytellers, and they can't stand to be in a box. It was really boring when we all had to say, I am a woman with brown hair. Here is my white woman with brown hair fantasy. I mean, it was, everybody felt like obligated to be first person and confessional, as if that made it more real or more compelling. But in fact, writers like to pretend they're everyone. And they don't want to have to be themselves all the time. They want to tell you a really good story and make you believe it.
We get enough of being ourselves in real life.
Exactly.
All right. Thanks for joining us, Susie.
And that was Susie Bright, editor of the Best American Erotica 2003, an interview I recorded last week. And that was played in the pinch because I couldn't get Ed Vulliamy to answer his phone. Ed Vulliamy, the UN correspondent for the Observer newspaper in Britain. I'll try again next week, see if I can get him to talk about what he's found out there. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. A reminder, I and Dean Baker will be on a panel talking about the U.S. economy this Sunday, 2 o'clock at St. Mark's Church in the Bowery, 2nd Avenue and 10th Street in Manhattan. And let's go out with a few seconds from Tattoo, those great anti-war protesters.